rural.
My cousin and her family and my family were the only ones I would call really literate in the sense of reading anything beyond the local papers and the big events of the day. When World War I happened, they knew about it and so on. But my first political memory was of Theodore Roosevelt's campaign for re-election. And I remember that especially, well, of course, his pictures, and the fact that my grandfather had a magnificent shillelagh, a friend of his had brought him from Ireland. And although he was a thoroughgoing Democrat and he had become a naturalized citizen in 1855, he said if Roosevelt won, he was going to send him his shillelagh. He didn't win, and I guess the shillelagh went to my cousin. But
tell me, after your master's, then did you go right on for PhD?
After my master's, my companion thought she wanted to go on for doctorate at Harvard, where there was a very great medieval scholar at the time. She was interested in medieval literature. Mm-hmm. Well, of course, Harvard was not coeducational then. I think she tried to engineer that to give me a little more sophistication. I had gone to Clark, which was a women's college in the Midwest, at a time when women's colleges, even the big ones, were a little on finishing school sort, you know. They didn't take them very seriously, except maybe Vassar and maybe Smith. Mm-hmm. The really big ones, Grinmore. And later on, when I was retired from Mundelein, one of my best friends in Philadelphia was a retired history professor from Bryn Mawr. She's an English woman. We just hit it off wonderful. But anyway, was delivered at the door of what we called the little greenhouse next door to the skyscraper, which was Mundelein Caucus. And the skyscraper had been topped off 2 hours before I got there. It had just reached maximum height. It would not be finished enough for us to move into it until September. The little greenhouse in which we lived was a green stucco residence, three stories, with servants' quarters. It was not any little cottage.
But it was a coach house.
It was little compared to Mundelein. Mm-hmm. And it was an absolutely wonderful experience. The first thing I had to tell you would have to know a good deal about religious life in 1930 to understand just what things were like. And I had lost a coin purse with $2 in it. When we came back from Boston, we had letters from the professor of Columbia, and they just practically wrapped up the then new, now it's the old library at Harvard, Widener Library, and gave it to us in pink ribbons. They were so nice to us. We were the only women I saw on campus outside, librarians and people. And I immediately acquired a nice carrel with a floor-to-ceiling window and desk, and permission to reserve for a week or maybe 2 weeks I had been sick in the middle of the year. You know, I was in Columbia when we were living in Senegal. And I had, the doctor had said, this was it, I can go back to school. But I did after 6 weeks. And I didn't have my dissertation finished. And I had finished that in Boston in that month. And mailed it back to Columbia on the Feast of the Sacred Heart, incidentally. And anyway, I arrived at Magdalen College 2 hours after the building, and the only building we would have for 3 years was topped off. And I had to go and report to Sister Mary Justicia that I had lost a purse with $2 in it. This was in the spring of 1930. The building had been commenced 2 days after the Wall Street crash. And money just...
There wasn't any.
$2 would have kept us in potatoes for a week, for 16 hours. And I had lost $2. And Sister Mary Justicia looked very serious. And she said, "Well, Sister, it was an unfortunate accident. I expected to be ripped to pieces." And one of the first duties assigned to me was to go on weekends or whenever she had finished a chapter with the dean-elect far down to Our Lady's Academy on the far south side of Chicago so that she could read her latest chapter to the chaplain there, who had been a seminary mate of Bishop Shield, Bishop Sheehan, I think it is, about whom she was writing her dissertation for the University of Illinois. And on the way back one day, a rather shabbily but tastefully dressed women gave each of us a dollar. Well, people weren't handing out dollars in those days easily. And I gave mine to Sister to give to Sister Mary Justicia with hers. And the next time I went to Sister's room on an errand, she said, "Well, Sister, did you recognize your $2? Which was such a beautiful thing for her to do. My regular assignment was as portress and as receptionist and the phone. Mm-hmm. There was a main phone on the first floor, and Sister had an extension in her bedroom, which was also her office, mm-hmm. on the second floor. And very shortly, I knew what I would be authorized to take care of, give my own judgment on, and what questions had to go to her, mm-hmm. as the authority. Mm-hmm. So I was running up and down stairs all the time. I weighed at that time, and I was good 2.5 inches taller than I am now, $112 in 8 pounds of serge and leather. And I didn't gain during the summer. But I became acquainted with the voices and questions of the architect and the construction manager. Mm-hmm. And of people who and we're trying very hard to get the orders for the new institution. One of them was, I believe, the brother-in-law of Cardinal Mundelein, or maybe a nephew-in-law, Mr. Epic, who was selling coal. And he was very persistent, and I used to argue very gently with him. But my big cross in that connection was the produce, particularly egg dealers. Mm-hmm. They all wanted to sell eggs for the cafeteria, so that regularly I would get this carton of a dozen eggs. And if you put enough water in them, you can make scrambled eggs for 16 people out of a dozen.
Yes.
And I loathed the eggs. Nothing could have made me eat eggs when I was a child. And the man would deliver this dozen eggs, and he'd be back the next day to see if they weren't the best eggs we had ever seen. And I would tell him how delicious they were and how nice it was, and that I had given his phone number and address to the incoming president. And he would go away, you know, happy but with his fingers crossed. And then...
Did you have any other duties during that summer?
Well, that was enough. The phones...
Oh, okay, the phones.
And doorbells just never stopped. We had a wonderful black and white collie named Fritz. This is my Robert Hughes brother had given us. And he had a bark that would intimidate an army. And one night he got the two sisters who slept downstairs in what had been the dining room of the servants originally up with his barking, and they went all through the house, and there was nothing out of sorts they could see. When they opened the basement door and started down, the dog trotted around behind them with his tail between his legs, whimpering. And they got down, and there was an open window. And the next morning, he discovered a silver coffee service someone had given us was missing from the dining room. And that was that. And another morning, Prince was barking terribly out near the front door. So I went and looked out, and there was Prince on the ground, jumping up and down. And the postman lying on the railing of the porch with his heels in the air.
Prince was protecting all of you.
I said, Prince. And Prince looked at me and lowered his head. He knew he was misbehaving, and put his tail between his legs and trotted around to the backyard. And we had to go for a walk right after breakfast. This is getting more into the religious life than the academic, you understand. And Sister Mary Justicia's way of getting acquainted with the latest sister to arrive was to take that sister for companion. You never went out except in twos. And I was the latest. So I was her companion. And we would walk down Kenmore to Rosemont, then over to Sheridan, and she would stand for some time gazing at the Sacred Heart School, which was brand new in French Renaissance. Mm-hmm. And she was directing a skyscraper in the very latest style. Mm-hmm. And then we would turn and walk up to the little beach. There were just residences, very, very nice ones, really mansions all along Sheridan at that time. And we'd stand and look out over the lake and her eyes were just the color of the lake at its very bluest. And then we would turn and walk over to the building, and of course they, men would all be working at that time. And she would say, she'd stand there until the boss appeared. And then she would say, "Mr. Provost, will you get so-and-so for me?" No, she'd say to the nearest man, "Mr. So-and-so." She knew their names. There were a lot of them. "Will you get Mr. Provost for me?" Well, he'd come back in a minute. He doesn't seem to be around. This would go along for about 3 trials. And finally, Mr. Provost would give up and come around. "Mr. Provost, I thought this, this, and this were going to be done by this time." "Well, sister, there'd be different reasons. Maybe material hadn't arrived." "Well, then get it, Mr. Provost." Or this had happened. Well, she had an answer for all of it. And Mr. Provost assured her everything would be taken care of. And we would go on to the little greenhouse. And she'd go up to her desk and I suppose figure out the finances and how many additional teachers we would need, how many secular teachers we might have to employ, and how much it would cost. And I would go back to answering bells, which would start ringing right away. And then there were always little things like typing and so forth, and studying, because we were going to be college teachers in the fall. Here we were. I had had nothing but practice teaching for elementary work, because my mother had insisted that along with my college degree, I get a teacher's certificate. It meant that one semester I carried 21 hours and the next 23, but I didn't.
Was it while you were at Clark that you became interested in community life, or maybe talk to
me
about that a little bit?
Well, it wasn't through Clark exactly, except, you know, the religion courses at Clark, as far as I was concerned, were the birds. They took those of us who were public school products, taught how to say the rosary in the station, things I had known from the age of 4, you know. And I had real theological questions. And it wasn't anybody who was, they just thought that was not what I was supposed to be thinking about. I could get all the answers right there in the catechism. And then finally, in senior year, we had rather hard-bitten old philosophy teacher from Loris. I was just there for one semester at the end, because I had taken so many courses, I had plenty to quit. I didn't need even that last 6 months, but that last semester. But on account of North Central, I had to come back home. And he gave a course called Introduction to Philosophy, and it was awfully good. And the girl thought I was terribly courageous. I didn't think anything about it. I just naturally walked along with him when he went out to his car after class and asked questions, talked with him. I liked the old guy. And that was, he was the only one I really could ask theological questions about. I think maybe he kind of liked me, took an interest in me, because he had a question in a test about time. I don't remember what the question was, but I said I didn't recall the class discussion of the question, but that St. Augustine said, time is the measure of change. And I think he was so surprised that somebody in the class had read St. Augustine. Well, I loved St. Augustine. My father had named him Augustine because he liked St. Augustine. So I had read, on account of being curious about my father's name, I had read the Confessions of St. Augustine and the City of God. And I was fascinated by it. And to go back to the religion matter, I had planned diligently from first year high school to be a foreign correspondent in Spain. I got Spain from a quarrel with my family on the 4th of July when I was in, I think, 8th grade. The neighbors were going on a picnic over on the Sharon. My parents weren't going. They were older than my friend's parents. We're not interested in going. But my friends all wanted me to come along with them, and I wanted to go. And I was not permitted to go. It was some years later I discovered it was because some of my friends' fathers celebrated a little too much on these occasions, and my parents didn't want me to see that loss of dignity. But I wanted my mother, who was the principal disciplinarian, my father felt that daughters were a matter for mothers to take care of, and sons, if there were any, for the fathers. Well, I had no brothers. I had a handicapped babysitter. But to make my mother see how cruel she was and how much I was suffering, I took her best quilt and put it down on the grass in plain view of what now would be called it was a big window, a very large window in front, lawn, and took what looked like the dullest book in the library. It had a dull red maroon silk cover with the small letters of the author's name in gold on the cover, old-fashioned Victorian volume. And the pages were a little bit yellow. And lay down on that quilt for that book. And the book was Washington Irving's Alhambra, and I was fascinated. I read from right after breakfast until it was so dark I couldn't see anymore. Normally, I would have been expected to be doing the dishes and doing other household tasks. But Mother thought I was sulking. She didn't even call me in for lunch. I could just suffer. I didn't think of lunch. I didn't think of anything but Granada and the Alhambra. And from then on, I just had to get to Spain, especially because my grandmother was very proud of her Spanish blood, which must have been pretty thin by the time it got to her. Some Spanish official had stayed with her ancestors when they were lords of Oscillation. And when he and his family went back to Spain, I have an idea he was conspiring against Queen Elizabeth. One of the girls stayed behind and married one of the German boys, and that was where her grandmother got her Spanish blood. But anyhow, that settled it. And for freshman year high school, my very best friend stayed with relatives in the little town nearest us, Atlanta, during the week and went to school in the little high school there. Well, Mother didn't think very much of the little high school for a variety of reasons. So I was sent to the Sisters of St. Joseph Carondelet at Chillicothe, Missouri, their boarding school. And I had marvelous teachers there. And one of my English papers came back with, and the teacher we had for English was really a modern man. But this paper came back with good or excellent all over the place in red. And I was so thrilled watching that crow over there. I just thought, these crows, they're gorgeous things. And so I sent the paper home. And my father was so thrilled. Father had had to withdraw from school when he was 12 years old. And his mother died. Mm-hmm. She sent for him on his deathbed and said he would have to stop school. His brothers would have to help his father on the farm. My grandfather had bought property. That was the only thing in Ireland in his day because it was under the thumb of the English conquerors. So that owning land was the big thing for Irish, most Irish people when they came over here. He came in 48. And the family, and the two older boys would have to help him outside. So he would have to stay home and take care of the house and of his little sisters, see that they were clean and were properly dressed and went to school and that the house was clean and ordered. And he did that and he managed to read. And grandfather, like a good many of those early Irish, was quite a reader himself. Mm-hmm. And he must have had a little bit of French or knowledge of it because there was a quote here and there in his diary. But anyway, I sometimes thought, you know, it's strange the way the providence of God works. If Father had been able to continue school, he would have had reading and writing and arithmetic up to what today would be junior high school. As it was, he had time to read anything he could get his hands on and to study what interested him most, which was science. And the Indians who lived on a little plot of land, I think there was something like 26 acres, that had not been taken up yet. It wasn't the reservation, but this tribe had simply shrunk and they had moved back and back and back as the whites took more and more and more of their property. And they lived there and they traveled around trading horses. Sometimes the women were out begging. And my father was fascinated by them. And he didn't become acquainted with them as far as I know. But he watched, and any time he had to sew any of them, he watched them. And later on, when his youngest sister was 18, they decided to sell the property. And my grandfather would have a third of it. Those are the results. And the children, the rest would be divided among the children. And when that was done, the three boys pooled their lot and divided it among the four girls. Because they thought it was easier for boys to make their way than for girls. And the girls took off from Colorado Springs because the neighbors had gone there. And it sounded new and interesting and exotic. And the boys, my father and his older brother John, took a time out and went up and worked in Wisconsin on a lumber gang for a term to get enough money to start out on their own. And Father took a walking trip. This was the year after the Custer Massacre. He got as far as Jamestown, North Dakota, with the money that he had earned, and took a job as a busboy in the hotel there. And he used to tell about the time the town was threatened by Indians. And this crowd of Indians, it was the year after the massacre, were congregated in the valley beyond the town, dancing, doing their war dances, and the custom was to dance until daybreak and then attack. And all the men of the town were lying on the ground, looking over the brow of the hill, watching them. And at 2 a.m, the Indian scouts came back and reported that the militia were on the way. Jamestown had no soldiers.